Story number 6, King David, a real lady killer. 1 Samuel chapter 27. Judging from the Bible's description of King David's physical appearance, one might rightly conclude that David was quite the lady killer, metaphorically speaking. Judging from the events described in 1 Samuel chapter 27, one also might rightly conclude that David was quite the lady killer, literally speaking. One of the first times we learn about David is in the familiar story in which he slays Goliath, the giant Philistine from the city of Gath. David pulls off this heroic feat using nothing more than his sling and a stone. From that day forward, David became something of a celebrity in Israel. In the early days of his fame and prior to his becoming king, Saul, who was then king, looked very favorably upon young David. David had become a member of Saul's army and rose quickly through the ranks. But the day came when David's popularity exceeded that of Saul's. This made Saul insanely jealous, so much so, in fact, that he eventually tried to have David killed. The cat-and-mouse game that followed led David, along with his two wives and his 600 faithful warriors and their families, to seek refuge among, of all people, the Philistines. It seems that David had made friends with a man by the name of Achish, who turns out to be, of all people, son of the king of Gath. Now, David must have been quite the charmer because Gath, you may recall, was the hometown of Goliath, the giant Philistine, whom David had killed. That little episode with Goliath notwithstanding, the Bible tells us that Achish liked David so much that he gave to him the city of Ziklag. And it was here in Ziklag that David and his entourage would live for the next 16 months. Now, not one to let the grass grow under his feet, David kept himself and his men busy by engaging in the popular Israelite pastime of killing their neighbors. For David and his 600 merry men, these raids appear to have been a regular activity. "Where did you go raiding today?" was a question Achish routinely put to his friend David. The manner in which these raids were conducted is described in 1 Samuel chapter 27, verse 9, which reads, quote, "Whenever David attacked an area, he did not leave a man or a woman alive, but took sheep and cattle, donkeys and camels, and clothes. Then he returned to Achish." Unquote. Now there's a familiar drill. Kill all the men and all the women, and then loot the place. It seems that little has changed since the days of Joshua. Now could it be possible that in addition to killing all the adults, that the great and wonderful David killed all the children as well? Consider David's motive for killing his victims in the first place. We find this motive in 1 Samuel 27, verse 11, which reads, quote, "He, David, did not leave a man or woman alive to be brought back to Gath, for he thought, they might inform on us and say, this is what David did. And such was his practice as long as he lived in Philistine territory." Unquote. Now, given that David's aim here was to kill anyone who might possibly inform on him, is it not safe to assume that anyone old enough to inform would have to be killed? Surely, any child age 5 or older would be perfectly capable of telling someone how David and his gang had murdered his parents and stole their animals. What do you suppose David did when he came across such a child? The scripture gives no indication that David took with him any of these children, only the sheep and cattle, donkeys and camels and clothes, the loot, right? And how about those children too young to inform? Toddlers and infants. Having killed off their parents, do you think David simply left these children behind to fend for themselves? Now, I'm speculating here, but assuming that these events took place at all, don't you think it's possible, even probable, that David dealt with these children in the very same way that Moses and Joshua dealt with the children of Midian and Heshbon and Bashan and Jericho and Ai and the many other cities that they had conquered? In other words, don't you think it's possible, even probable, that David just killed these kids? I think it is. But again, I'm speculating here. We don't really know for sure. Something else we don't know for sure is just how many people lost their lives during this period of raiding. Again, assuming that these events took place at all, one could make the case that a whole lot of people lost their lives. 1 Samuel 27, verse 7 tells us that David conducted these raids on a regular basis for well over a year. 16 months, to be exact. Consider, too, that David conducted these raids with 600 of what were probably the most efficient killing machines on the planet. These were elite, battle-hardened warriors, the best of the best. But perhaps the most important thing to keep in mind here is that these were raids, not battles. David and his Delta Force were not going up against other soldiers as during a time of war, but civilian populations who clearly offered little resistance. Ponder this. 1 Samuel 30 verse 9 reveals that throughout this entire 16-month period of raiding, David did not lose even one of his 600 warriors. Maybe David should try picking on someone his own size for a change. Story number 7. Don't look at that ark. 1 Samuel chapters 4 through 6. Many times in the Old Testament we read about the Israelites going to battle against the Philistines. On one such occasion, the Philistines handed the Israelites an especially painful defeat. The number of Israel's dead topped 30,000, but that was hardly the worst part. After all, people in the Bible, even God's chosen people, were fairly expendable. No, the worst part about this particular defeat was that during the battle, the Philistines had captured the legendary Ark of the Lord's Covenant, the most sacred and holy object in the entire universe. When news got back to Israel that the ark had been taken, old men had heart attacks and pregnant women went into labor. The news really shook Israel. But things weren't going any better for the victorious Philistines. Trouble just seemed to follow the ark. For example, the Philistines originally placed the ark in their temple next to their god, the statue Dagon. Almost immediately, bad things begin happening to Dagon. First, he falls off his stand and lands face down in front of the Israelite ark. If that wasn't bad enough, the very next day Dagon's head falls off and smashes into pieces on the ground. The Philistines couldn't very well allow for that, so they decided to move the ark to another city. But the arrival of the ark was accompanied by an outbreak of painful tumors, which wound up killing many of the city's people. Panicked, the Philistines tried moving the ark again, but the death and destruction just tagged along. It seems the Philistines couldn't live with the ark any better than the Israelites could without it. Eventually, the Philistines came to the humbling realization that they were going to have to give the damn thing back. And that's exactly what they did. Now, knowing something of the Lord's partiality to ceremony, and knowing that the Ark of the Lord's Covenant was the quintessential object of Israelite ceremony, the Philistines wanted to make sure that when they did send the Ark back, they did so correctly. And who could blame them? Leviticus chapter 10 tells of an occasion in which God actually sent fire down from heaven and burned to death two Israelite priests because they had botched a ceremony. Understandably, the Philistines wanted to get this thing right the first time. And so, after a bit of research, the Philistines prepared a special offering in accordance with Israelite law, and they sent the offering, along with the ark, back to the Israelites on a cart pulled by a pair of cows. Good riddance. Well, eventually, the ark and the cows made their way back to Israel, to the town of Beth Shemesh. And as you might imagine, the return of the ark was met with much joy. Unfortunately, this joy turned out to be short-lived. Tragically, for the people of Beth Shemesh, the value God placed on the ark far exceeded the value he placed on human life. In 1 Samuel 6, verse 19, we learn what happens next. Quote, "And he, God, smote the men of Beth Shemesh, because they had looked into the ark of the Lord. Even he smote of the people 50,010 men. And the people lamented, because the Lord had smitten many of the people with a great slaughter." Unquote. So what began as a day of great celebration suddenly collapses into a day of great mourning. More than 50,000 people had lost their lives because they had committed the unspeakable crime of staring at a gold-plated piece of wood. What were these people thinking? I'd like to switch gears now. Unless you're a student of the Bible, I'm guessing that many of the stories we've talked about up to this point are ones that you don't know. What I'd like to do now is turn our attention to some Bible stories that you probably do know. although I doubt that you learned about these stories in the manner they'll be presented here. You see, when most people are taught these stories, they are so cloaked in tradition and presumed goodness that the brutal nature of the stories never quite sinks in. In this presentation, we strip away all these presumptions and lay bare the ugly realities that lie underneath. That said, let's turn our attention to these stories now. Story number 8, Noah and the Ark, Genesis chapter 6. The first of these stories is that of Noah and the Ark and the Great Flood. The story is a familiar one. God's prized creation, man, has become so wicked that God decides to throw in the towel, kill everyone off, and start all over again. God tells us how he plans to do this in Genesis 6, verse 17, which reads, quote, "I am going to bring floodwaters on the earth to destroy all life under the heavens. Every creature that has the breath of life in it, everything on earth, will perish." Unquote. And destroy all life under the heavens is exactly what God did, with a few well-known exceptions, of course. The Bible tells us that God spared a righteous man named Noah, Noah's family, and one male and one female from every kind of animal on the earth. As the story goes, Noah's family and their animal friends piled into a great big boat called an ark, and there they floated safely on the floodwaters while the rest of creation perished under 40 days and nights of nonstop rain. Not many people realize this, but although the rain lasted for only 40 days, the entire earth and even the highest mountains was covered with water for more than a year. This means that Noah and his family and all those wild animals were trapped in a urine-soaked box of gopher wood for more than a year. And amazingly, not a single living thing on the ark died. Now that is a miracle. Well, eventually, and thankfully, God sent forth a wind over the earth that caused the waters to recede, exposing the dry land. You might recall from your Sunday school days that Noah learned about the dry land after a dove that he had released returned to the ark bearing an olive branch. Now that raises an interesting question. Where did this olive tree come from? I mean, how does an olive tree manage to survive for more than a year under miles of salt water? That little mystery was never addressed in any of my Sunday school classes. Anyway, the story ends with God's promise to never again destroy the earth by flood. And as a sign of this promise, God places a beautiful rainbow in the sky. Apparently the first one ever. Of course, as with any good contract, God leaves himself a loophole. For example, in the book of Revelation we learn of God's intention to destroy the earth with fire. But we'll look into that matter in the next presentation, when we examine the New Testament. Now for most people, the story of Noah and the ark conjures up images of happy animals marching two by two into the ark, white doves, olive branches, and rainbows. It seems that the horrific atrocity that is really the core of this story has been all but lost through the numbing effects of time and tradition. In churches and homes all over America, little kids are taught a story that essentially glorifies an act of worldwide genocide like it was something out of Mother Goose. It's not at all uncommon to find the flood story portrayed in cartoons and coloring books. In fact, that's typically how children today are introduced to the story. But let's not kid ourselves here, folks. If we're going to accept the flood story as true, and that's pretty much how it's taught to children today, then we must also accept that God has just killed a bunch of children, perhaps many millions of them. How do you teach that to a child? A coloring book? How would you teach it to a 6-year-old girl named Susie? Oh yes, that's right, Susie. God made it rain for 40 days and 40 nights, and righteous Noah and his family and the doggies and kitties and giraffes and worms and all the other animals floated safely on the water in the ark. But a little boy named Jared, whose mommy and daddy were very, very bad, well, he didn't get to ride in the ark with Noah and all the animals. And when the rain came down and the water started getting really high, Jared started crying because he was scared and he didn't want to drown. And when the water got to be higher than his head, Jared choked and gurgled on the water that rushed into his tiny lungs. The water made his lungs sting and burn. Ouch! Then Jared panicked and screamed, but then Jared stopped screaming because he ran out of air to scream with. And then Jared's little fingers and toes started turning blue. And then his big brown eyes started to bulge and go real bloodshot. And then they popped right out of their sockets. I mean, clean out of his head. And then... well, I think you get the picture. Of course, if we really wanted to impress upon Susie the painful realities the people and animals face during the flood, we could toss her into the deep end of a nearby swimming pool and hold her little head under the water for a couple of minutes. That should do the trick. Better yet, why not go find a couple of stray cats, one male and one female, and hold them under the water for a while, or at least until the kitties stop moving. We could then place the kitty corpses in Susie's now trembling hands and explain to her that this is what her Heavenly Father does to people who get on his bad side. We should then open our Bibles to Genesis 6:17 and remind Susie that what just happened to these two kitties and what nearly happened to her is exactly what happened to every single human being and every single animal living on the earth at the time of Noah. We seldom hear this story told from the victim's perspective. Something else we seldom hear are estimates of just how many people may have lost their lives in the flood. I think it's worth our time to consider this. For if the flood happened as the Bible says it did, and if conditions prior to the flood were indeed as the Bible says they were, then we have every reason to believe that the earth's population just prior to the flood was huge. Consider the following six conditions that, according to the Bible, existed prior to the flood. Condition number one. The pre-flood population had 1,656 years in which to grow. We arrive at this figure by consulting the genealogy of the pre-flood patriarchs found in Genesis chapter 5. Now consider that in recent times, we've seen the world's population grow from about 2 billion in 1930 to about 4 billion in 1980. In other words, in modern times, we've seen the world's population double over a 50-year period. Now, if a population of two people, let's call them Adam and Eve, doubled in size every 50 years, then after 1,656 years, this population of two will have grown to well over 8 billion. Yes, I said billion with a B. Condition number two. According to Genesis chapter 5, the patriarchs from Adam to Noah, with the exception of Enoch, lived an average of 912 years. Now, we have to exclude Enoch because he didn't really die. Instead, he was kind of magically sucked up into heaven by God at the relatively youthful age of 365. But the remaining patriarchs lived an average of 912 years. These extremely long lifespans suggest that the world prior to the flood may have been somewhat disease-free. And why not? According to the Bible, the world was practically brand new. Condition number three. In Genesis 1 verse 27, God explicitly commands Adam and Eve to be fruitful and increase in numbers. And they did. Condition number four. People were capable of having children well into their golden years. For example, Genesis 5:32 reveals that Noah was at least 500 years old before the birth of his sons Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Condition number five. The people were probably having a lot of sex. After all, if these doomed people were half as wicked as the Bible makes them out to be, then why would they bother with something as morally inconvenient as sexual abstinence? And finally, condition number six. The science of birth control was not what it is today. In light of information found in the Bible itself, a pre-flood population explosion was all but inevitable. For not only was there plenty of time for the population to grow to an immense size, but the physical characteristics of the people, combined with the likely behavior of the people, were factors conducive to rapid growth as well. If the flood really happened as the Bible says it did, then it seems quite probable that many billions of people lost their lives as a result. And of those billions of people, a considerable portion must have been children. Try to picture in your mind millions upon millions of children, little girls and boys, floating lifeless in an ocean of rain, the pain of asphyxiation still etched into their faces, and their tiny bodies bobbing up and down in the floodwaters, dead, bloated, stinking. And all compliments of a deluge God willfully sent upon the earth when he lost his temper with their parents. You see, that's what comes to mind when I think of the flood. No doves, no olive branches, no rainbows, just a whole lot of dead people. Not the kind of stuff you're likely to find in a coloring book. Story number 9, Abraham and Isaac, Genesis chapter 22. Another popular Old Testament story that never receives the in-depth scrutiny it really deserves is the story of Abraham, his son Isaac, and the burnt offering. The story is found in Genesis chapter 22. In this story, we find Abraham out and about one fine day, minding his own business, when out of the blue God tells him to do something unthinkable. In verse 2, God tells Abraham, quote, "Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains I will tell you about." Unquote. By telling Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, God was telling Abraham to kill Isaac. But God was telling Abraham to do far more than simply kill Isaac. God was telling Abraham to sacrifice Isaac as a burnt offering. And as we will soon see, sacrificing a human being as a burnt offering is a far cry from lethal injection or a quick bullet to the back of the head. Allow me to explain. The proper way to perform a burnt offering is found in Leviticus chapter 1. Leviticus 1 describes a burnt offering as a gruesome ceremony requiring the ritualistic killing, dismemberment, and burning of certain animals. None of the animals slain during these rituals was ever eaten. They were simply cut into pieces and then burned into oblivion. That God would order his people to perform this ghastly ritual on animals is bad enough. That he would order a man to perform it on one of his children is simply off the charts. To help you get a feel for what's really going on here, I want to read to you those verses from Leviticus that describe exactly how a burnt offering is to be performed. But I'm going to paraphrase things just a bit by inserting, where appropriate, the names of Abraham and Isaac. I present the verses in this way to give you some idea of what Abraham was really up against. I use as my reference Leviticus chapter 1, verses 4 through 9. I invite you to read along. They go something like this. Abraham is to lay his hand on the head of his son Isaac, and it will be accepted on Abraham's behalf to make atonement for him. Abraham is to slaughter Isaac before the Lord. Then Abraham shall bring the blood of Isaac and sprinkle it against the altar on all sides. Next, Abraham is to skin Isaac, his son, his little boy, and cut him into pieces. Then Abraham shall arrange the pieces of his son's body, including Isaac's head and his fat, on the burning wood that is on the altar. Abraham is to wash Isaac's inner parts and his legs with water, and shall then burn all of Isaac, his son, on the altar. This is a burnt offering, an offering made by fire, an aroma pleasing to the Lord. So this is a burnt offering. This is what God was telling Abraham to do to his little boy. Now, most people don't give this stuff a whole lot of thought. They should, but they don't. In trying to understand this indifference, I've come to the conclusion that people do one of three things. One, they have no idea that such a story exists. Two, they know the story exists, but they don't understand the gruesome nature of God's request. Or three, they read the story in the Bible, and because the story is found in the Bible, they assume that whatever's going on, well, it must be something good. But folks, come on now. I mean, just how lurid do things have to get before what the words on the page are trying to tell us finally starts to sink in? God has just commanded this man to murder his son, and in a manner that would shock the likes of Charles Manson. Yet the only thing most people ever take away from this story is a profound respect for Abraham's willingness to carry out God's will. Only an uncritical presumption of biblical goodness could lead a person to believe that Abraham's resolve to barbecue his own boy was a good thing. Of course, right about now, some of you are probably thinking, hey, wait a minute. When we read a little further into Genesis 22, we find out that Isaac wasn't killed at all. He was spared. And if that's what you're thinking, then you're absolutely correct. Isaac was spared. It seems that just before Abraham thrust his knife into Isaac's body, an angel appeared and told Abraham that God has just called the whole thing off. In fact, it seems that God never intended for Abraham to kill his son in the first place. This was just one of those little practical jokes God likes to play on his people at times. The Bible euphemistically refers to these episodes as tests. So God was only testing Abraham. God was not testing a man named Jephthah. Let me tell you about Jephthah. Jephthah was a mighty warrior and man of God who lived during that part of Israel's history recorded in the book of Judges. Jephthah was appointed to lead a branch of the Israelites known as the Gileadites against one of Israel's archenemies, the Ammonites. Before going to battle against the Ammonites, Jephthah, like any good man of God, sought the help of the Lord. In Judges 11:30 we read, quote, "And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord, saying, 'If you will give the Ammonites into my hands, whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph from the Ammonites will be the Lord's, and I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering.'" Unquote. The Bible tells us that Jephthah did triumph over the Ammonites, destroying some 20 towns in the process. That's the good news. The bad news is that when Jephthah returned to his house to see which of his animals would meet him and thus become the object of his burnt offering, he was met not by one of his animals, but by his daughter. His only daughter. His only child. Now, I know that keeping one's vow is pretty important in the Bible. But if ever there was a legitimate exception to this vow business, you'd think it would be now. Right? I mean, you'd think that God would step in at this point and say something like, "Look, Jephthah, I know what you were thinking. You thought that when you returned from battle that you'd be met by one of your animals, and it would be one of your animals that you would sacrifice. I know you weren't thinking about slicing your daughter's throat from ear to ear, tearing the skin off her body, cutting off her head, chopping her into little pieces, and then burning her dismembered carcass into oblivion. I know you didn't mean that. So I tell you what. Why don't you just take one of those animals over there, sacrifice it, and we'll call it even." Of course, God could have done that. God could have intervened here, just as he had intervened with Abraham. But this time, God chose not to intervene. Of course, God also had the power to make sure that upon returning from battle, Jephthah was met by a rat or a cockroach, rather than his daughter. But God didn't do that either. What God did to Abraham and Jephthah, not to mention their kids, was as cruel as it was unnecessary. And it kind of makes you wonder that if this is how God treats his best and brightest, what could he possibly have in store for the rest of us? Story number 10, Egypt and the 10 Plagues, Exodus chapters 1 through 12. Earlier in this presentation, we looked at some lesser-known stories about the prophet Moses. Now I'd like to take a look at a story that perhaps more than any other really puts Moses on the map. The story to which I refer now is that of Moses and the plagues of Egypt, as told in the first several chapters of Exodus. In this story, God curses the Egyptian people with a series of 10 devastating plagues. The Bible leads us to believe that these plagues are being inflicted on the Egyptian people in an effort to force Pharaoh to free the Israelites from bondage. Now, just in case you don't recall what occurred during each of these plagues, here's a quick rundown of the first 9. In plague number 1, all the water throughout the land of Egypt is turned into blood. This bizarre plague affects not only the water in Egypt's famous Nile River, but even the water in the people's wooden buckets and stone jars. Naturally, all the fish die, and this in turn creates a dreadful stench that can be smelled throughout the entire land. In plague number 2, millions of frogs appear and infest every nook and cranny of Egyptian life. In fact, there are so many frogs that when the frogs eventually die and the cleanup begins, the dead frogs are piled up into huge heaps, And as you might imagine, they don't smell any better than the fish. In plague number 3, thick clouds of gnats infest the Egyptian people. They infest their land, their homes, their beds, everything. In plague number 4, huge dense swarms of flies invade the people. And like the gnats, the flies also find their way into every part of Egyptian life. In plague number 5, all the Egyptian livestock are killed. In plague number 6, the Egyptian people, and even their animals, are inflicted with painful, festering boils. In plague number 7, the Egyptian people are smitten with a fiery hailstorm. This hailstorm is so destructive that any person or animal caught standing in it is killed. In plague number 8, swarms of locusts devour all the Egyptian crops. And in plague number 9, a thick darkness covers the land for 3 days. At any time during this ordeal, Pharaoh could have brought these plagues to an abrupt halt by simply granting the Israelites their freedom. But he didn't do that. And thanks to Pharaoh's apparent stubbornness, the Egyptian people were forced to endure these unspeakable hardships. Just try to put yourself in the place of the average Egyptian. You've just seen all the water in your rivers, your sinks, your toilets, everywhere, turned into blood. Your land and your home, inside and out, have been invaded by zillions of frogs, gnats, and flies. Your body and the bodies of your loved ones are covered with painful, oozing boils. You've been bombarded with hailstones the size of bowling balls. All your livestock are dead. All your crops are dead. You have nothing to eat. And now the land is gripped with a darkness so thick that you can almost feel it. If you're an Egyptian, you've got to be saying to yourself, "All right already. Enough is enough." As it turns out, the Egyptian people had indeed had enough. In fact, their whole attitude towards Moses and the Israelites has changed. We read in Exodus 11, verse 3, quote, "The Lord made the Egyptians favorably disposed toward the Israelite people, and Moses himself was highly regarded in Egypt by Pharaoh's officials and by the people." Unquote. Obviously, the Egyptian people were caught in the crossfire of a battle of wits between God and Pharaoh. The Egyptian people, and even Pharaoh's advisors, wanted no part of this macho suicide. So Pharaoh is now alone in wanting to keep the Israelites in bondage. Pharaoh is the only person standing between the Israelites and their freedom. So what was Pharaoh's problem? Was he just some kind of macho jerk out to defend his sense of pride at all costs? Or was there something more than old-fashioned testosterone at work here? To answer that question, let me read to you something God said to Moses during his stay in the land of Midian, long before any of these plagues had taken place. God tells Moses in Exodus 4, verse 21, quote, "When you return to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders I have given you the power to do. But I will harden his heart, so that he will not let the people go." Unquote. So there's our answer. God hardened Pharaoh's heart, and that's why Pharaoh would not let the Israelites go. God is the brains behind Pharaoh's stupidity. So can you see what's going on here? All of this death and destruction, all of this stubbornness and stupidity, is being orchestrated by God for effect. Now, if you think I might be reading something into the story that's not really there, consider what the Lord tells Pharaoh in Exodus 9:15, just after sending the plague of hail. Quote, "For by now I could have stretched out my hand and struck you and your people with a plague that would have wiped you off the face of the earth. But I have raised you up for this very purpose, that I might show you my power and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth." Unquote. So do you see what's happening here? God is staging and orchestrating and choreographing this whole mess of destruction just so he can make himself look cool and godly and powerful. Talk about an ego. Let me ask you something here. Does it bother you at all that God would influence the behavior of one human being just so he could appear justified in killing and torturing a whole bunch of other human beings? Is that moral and just? Is it moral and just for God to create a human being for the sole purpose of destroying that human being, simply to impress another human being with his awesome power to destroy? Like it or not, this is what the Bible is teaching us here. It's a disturbing concept, to be sure, but it's a concept that appears often in the Bible, even in the New Testament. Listen to what the Apostle Paul has to say on the subject in the book of Romans, chapter 9, beginning with verse 18. Quote, "Therefore God has mercy on whom he wants to have mercy, and he hardens whom he wants to harden." One of you will say to me, "Then why does God still blame us? For who resists his will?" But who are you, O man, to talk back to God? Shall what is formed say to him who formed it, "Why did you make me like this?" Does not the potter have the right to make out of the same lump of clay some pottery for noble purposes and some for common use? What if God, choosing to show his wrath and make his power known, bore with great patience the objects of his wrath, prepared for destruction? What if he did this to make the riches of his glory known to the objects of his mercy, whom he prepared in advance for glory? Unquote. Wouldn't it be comforting to know that the only reason that you exist is to be blown to bits in some demonstration of God's power? Frankly, I find Paul's words about as comforting as the prospect of being reincarnated as a bottle rocket. Be that as it may, this doctrine of predestination lies at the very core of New Testament Christianity. We'll revisit Paul's words to the Romans in the next presentation when we examine the New Testament. For now, though, suffice it to say that it was God himself who orchestrated Pharaoh's actions in order to prolong this deadly battle of wits and thus appear justified in delivering all 10 plagues. And oh yes, God did deliver all 10 plagues. So far, we've looked at 9 of these. We have already established that the Egyptian people and even Pharaoh's advisors were quite willing, even anxious, to grant the Israelites their freedom. In light of this, you might think that God would now restrict his wrath to the one person who stood between Israel and their freedom, namely Pharaoh. Is that what God did? No. And why not? Because God wasn't finished yet. There was still one more plague to go. And for his grand finale, God really pulls out all the stops. In the 10th and final plague, God kills all the firstborn in Egypt. Exodus 12:29 documents this event. Quote, "At midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on the throne, to the firstborn of the prisoner who was in the dungeon, and the firstborn of all the livestock as well. Pharaoh and all his officials and all the Egyptians got up during the night, and there was loud wailing in Egypt, for there was not a house without someone dead." Unquote. Well, doesn't that just make a whole lot of sense? Of all the people who could have possibly been guilty of some great crime, surely it was not these firstborn children. What if during the first Gulf War, General Norman Schwarzkopf had told Saddam Hussein something like, "Mr. Hussein, if you do not surrender to the United States today, we're going to kill all of your country's children"? How do you think a strategy like that would fare in opinion polls? Not very well, I would imagine. Yet the killing of these Egyptian children, an event known as the Passover, seems to have fared very well in opinion polls over the centuries. Instead of loathing this mass murder of innocents, people instead celebrate the event every year. During the festival of Passover, religious Jews gather with family and friends, prepare ritual meals, and sing praises to God, the killer himself, and all to commemorate the murder of thousands of children. Even Jesus celebrated Passover. Jesus of Nazareth, the most celebrated and universally adored person in the history of the world, the Son of God himself, celebrated the murder of thousands of children. Ponder that. The purpose of this presentation has been to bring to your awareness the existence of Bible stories like those we've examined here. I think it's extremely important that people be aware that there's more to the Bible than golden rules and Good Samaritans. The Bible has a very ugly side to it, a side that reveals a very different God and a very different morality from that which we have been led to believe by nearly every significant authority figure in our society, from our presidents to our parents. Now, granted, coming to terms with these stories is not always a pleasant experience, but I think you'll find it a useful experience. For starters, being in possession of the facts certainly beats the alternative. For as unpleasant as these stories are, don't you think that you are better equipped to develop an informed opinion about the Bible now that you have a more complete understanding of what's actually in the Bible? Well, of course you are. And there are many other benefits to be gained by coming to terms with the Bible's darker side, some of which are truly profound. Perhaps foremost among these is that this awareness forces us to more fully come to grips with what we believe and why we believe it. Confronted with these stories, we are forced to reconcile our perception of the Bible with what's actually in the Bible. Just as important, if not more important, we are forced to reconcile what is in the Bible with what we believe constitutes moral versus immoral behavior. Think of it like this. If you believe in God, and if you believe God is morally perfect, and if you believe the Bible is God's inspired word, but at the very same time you believe the intentional killing of women and children is morally wrong, well, you've got some reconciling to do. For as we have seen, the Bible contains a whole bunch of stories in which God orders his people to kill women and children. Given the presence of these stories, how can we continue to view the Bible as the ultimate moral guide? The answer, very simply, is that we can't. Something has got to give. Either we admit to ourselves that the Holy Bible is not such a good book after all, or we redefine what we mean by morality. Either way, something has got to give. And that's the hardest part of this reconciliation process. Giving up some long-held and cherished belief when the facts demand it of us. But if we desire to grow intellectually and morally, we must be willing to ask questions, even the hard questions. Especially the hard questions. Like Socrates, we must be willing to question everything and then accept the answers reality gives us. To be sure, confronting these stories can be unnerving. After all, for many people, myself included at one time, merely entertaining the idea that the Bible might be less than morally perfect, and worse still, that it might not even be true, well, this requires a lot of people to entirely rethink their paradigm of reality. This is a very big deal indeed. This is bigger than finding out that there's no Santa Claus. Of course, there is a positive side to all of this. You come out the other end of this process knowing what you believe and why you believe it. Your beliefs are truly your own, and not just some unexamined, uncritically swallowed, politically correct hand-me-down. Moreover, you gain an increased confidence in your own rational capacities, in your capacity to judge true and false, right and wrong. This confidence creates within you a sort of faith, for lack of a better word, but not a faith in some ancient mythical being, but a faith in yourself. Beyond helping us grow into more independent thinkers, becoming aware of the Bible's violent side helps us to understand the motivations behind many of history's darkest episodes. For example, you're probably aware that during the late 1600s, a number of so-called witches were executed in Salem, Massachusetts. Most historical commentators attribute this dark episode to the psychological insecurities of a handful of religious nuts. Consequently, they branded these infamous witch hunts as an aberration of human behavior, fanatical thinking run amok. And in some ways they're right. But that's hardly the whole story. Consider this. The Old Testament tells us in Exodus 22 verse 18, quote, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live," unquote. In other words, kill witches. Pretty straightforward, don't you think? Now, it seems to me that if I'm a person who believes the Bible to be the Word of God, And if I am committed to living myself in accordance with the Bible's teachings, then it seems only logical that should I find myself in the company of a witch, that I really have no choice but to kill that witch. After all, the Bible says, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live." Again, historians typically brand these Salem witch hunters as fanatics. But given what the Bible explicitly teaches about witches, and given that most people are taught from early childhood to follow the Bible's teachings, why on earth would we expect these so-called fanatics to act in any way other than what they did? Now, don't get me wrong here. I'm not trying to take away from the guilt of those involved. But I do want to call your attention to the fact that many millions of otherwise rational human beings who will not hesitate to condemn the killing of witches as wrong will, in the very same breath, give an unqualified endorsement to a book that explicitly says the killing of witches is right, even a duty. There's something very wrong with this picture. We witness a similar dichotomy in the actions of people today. For example, you may recall that a few years ago, the leaders of the Southern Baptist Convention voted to boycott the Walt Disney Company because of its policy to extend health care benefits to the partners of its homosexual employees. The Baptist leaders cited other morality-based reasons for the boycott, but it was pretty obvious that Disney's progressive attitude towards gay people was the driving force behind the boycott. As you might imagine, when the boycott was announced, it created quite a stir, even among many Baptists. People inside and outside of the church who disagreed with the boycott said that they just couldn't understand how the leaders of a Christian organization, boasting a membership of more than 15 million, could behave with such hateful intolerance. After all, doesn't this kind of thinking go against everything Christianity stands for? Well, not exactly. Look, this is easy. Southern Baptists, like most people, have been taught from day one to believe in the Bible and to follow its teachings. And like it or not, the Bible clearly teaches that homosexuality is an abomination in the sight of God, an abomination worthy of death. Specifically, Leviticus 20:13 states, quote, "If a man lies with a man as one lies with a woman, both of them have done what is detestable. They must be put to death. Their blood will be on their own heads." Unquote. Now that's fairly unambiguous. If a man has sex with another man, both he and his partner ought to be put to death. That, very simply, is what the Bible has to say on the subject of homosexuality. Oh, and by the way, notice that there's nothing in there about health benefits. Quite the opposite, in fact. Despite the Bible's no-nonsense clarity on this issue, a lot of people today, many of whom will insist that they too believe in the Bible, look at the Baptist position and call it misguided and even immoral. Now, granted, from a purely secular point of view, one could make that argument. But given the fact that Southern Baptists embrace the Bible as the inerrant Word of God, and given what the Bible explicitly teaches about homosexuality, why would we expect these people to behave in any way other than what they did? Of course, when you really stop and think about it, the Baptist decision to boycott Disney seems pretty tame. I mean, telling people not to take the kids to Disneyland this summer seems far less harsh than telling them that gay people should be dragged out of their homes and murdered. The latter, of course, being the Bible's way of dealing with the issue. In closing, I want to make a prediction. I predict that having been exposed to these stories, you will never again be able to think of the Bible in the same way. That's my prediction. And I don't care if you're a lifelong Christian fundamentalist, an Orthodox Jew, or a hardcore atheist. I'm telling you right here now that you will never again be able to hear someone speak about the Holy Bible without being reminded of these murderous stories. Never again will you listen to Billy Graham tout the virtues of the Bible without recalling how this very same Bible tells how God once commanded a king to murder thousands of Amalekite children and babies. Never again will you watch some rabbi physically embrace a copy of the Torah without wondering how on earth any Jewish person could possibly embrace a book that so explicitly glorifies acts of genocide. I'm telling you right here and now, as one rational human being to another, If you have really listened to this presentation, you will never again be able to think of the Bible as a good book. How can I be so confident in my prediction? Very simple. You see, as much as we might want to think otherwise, these stories really are in the Bible. That's a fact. That's reality. That's the truth. And barring some kind of physical brain damage, you simply can't escape these facts. These stories are not going away. They are there. And let me assure you, we've barely scratched the surface. The Bible is loaded with this stuff. So what's the significance of all this, if any? Well, the significance is this. Most people today approach the Bible uncritically predisposed to believing that all of its teachings are good. Now, while it's true that there are good teachings in the Bible, I won't deny that. Still, the vast majority of the book is anything but good. Children are murdered in cold blood. People are stoned to death for the most petty of offenses. And decent men and women are condemned to an eternity of fiery torment for nothing more than their beliefs. Where's the goodness in that? Friends, let's be honest here. There is no goodness in that. Be that as it may, for centuries now, priests and kings, presidents and parents, have admonished those in their care to turn to the Holy Bible for their moral guidance. Given the fact that the Bible represents the moral trough from which so many generations have fed, is it any wonder that our history books are littered with inquisitions, crusades, witch hunts, and other crimes against humanity, all done in the name of God? And specifically, in the name of this God. The time is long overdue that we as rational beings rethink our beliefs about the Holy Bible. This rethinking begins with nothing more than a simple awareness. And it is this awareness, this starting point, that has been the purpose of this presentation. My name is Mike Earle. And this presentation is the first in a series of five I've entitled, Bible Stories Your Parents Never Taught You. In the next presentation, we'll turn our attention to the New Testament. I hope you'll join me. Until then, thanks for listening, and please take care.